Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record, program number 288. This is going to be a half hour in length, and it's an update on the assassination of President Kennedy. I've done many broadcasts about the JFK assassination, and in this program, we're going to update that particular investigation. We're going to be paying particular attention to information relating to the House Select Committee on Assassinations investigation. We're going to be reviewing some information from the remarkable recent book called Let Justice Be Done by Bill Davey. I interviewed Bill Davey for 2.5 hours in For the Record program number 190. And we're also going to be taking a look at an interesting connecting link between the late Iran-Contra drug smuggler Barry Seal, in one of whose planes George W. Bush likes to fly around, or did when he was governor of Texas, and the assassination of President Kennedy. We're going to begin with the following story. This is a Washington Post story by George Lardner, Jr. It was researched for us by a member of the listening audience. It's datelined March 26th. It's headlined, Study Backs Theory of Grassy Knoll, subtitled, New Research Puts Chance of Second JFK Gunman at 96%. The article reads as follows. The House Assassinations Committee may have been right after all. There was a shot from the grassy knoll. That was the key finding of the congressional investigation that concluded 22 years ago that President John F. Kennedy's murder in Dallas in 1963 was, quote, probably the result of a conspiracy, unquote. A shot from the grassy knoll meant that that two gunmen must have fired at the president within a split-second sequence. Lee Harvey Oswald, accused of firing 3 shots at Kennedy from a perch at the Texas School Book Depository, could not have been in 2 places at once. A special panel of the National Academy of Sciences subsequently disputed the evidence of a 4th shot contained on a police dicta belt of the sounds in Dealey Plaza that day. The panel insisted it was simply random noise, perhaps static, recorded about a minute after the shooting while Kennedy's motorcade was en route to Parkland Hospital. A new, peer-reviewed article in Science and Justice, a quarterly publication of Britain's Forensic Science Society, says the NAS's panel study was seriously flawed. It says the panel failed to take into account the words of a Dallas patrolman that show the gunshot-like noises that gunshot-like noises occurred, quote, at the exact instant that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, unquote. In fact, the author of the article, D.B. Thomas, a government scientist and JFK assassination researcher, said it was more than 96% certain that there was a shot from the grassy knoll to the right side of the president's limousine, in addition to the 3 shots from a book depository window above and behind the president's limousine. G. Robert Blakey, former chief counsel to the House Assassinations Committee, said the NAS panel study always bothered him because it dismissed all 4 putative shots as random noise, even though the 3 sound bursts from the book depository matched up precisely with film of the assassination and other evidence such as the echo patterns in Dealey Plaza and the speed of Kennedy's motorcade. Quote, this is an honest, careful scientific examination of everything we did with all the appropriate statistical checks, unquote, Blakey said of Thomas's work. It shows that we made mistakes, too, but minor mistakes. The main thing is, when push comes to shove, he increased the degree of confidence that the shot from the grassy knoll was real, not static. We thought that there was a 95% chance it was a shot. He puts it at 96.3%. Either way, that's beyond a reasonable doubt, unquote. The sounds of assassination were recorded at Dallas Police Headquarters when a motorcycle patrolman inadvertently left his microphone switch in the on position, deluging his transmitting channel with what seemed to be motorcycle noise. Using sophisticated techniques, a team of scientists enlisted by the House committee filtered out the noise and came up with audible events, unquote, within a 10-second time frame that it believed might be gunfire. The Warren Commission had concluded in 1964 that only 3 shots, all from behind, all from Oswald's rifle, were fired in Dealey Plaza as the motorcade passed through. But the House experts, after extensive tests, found 10 echo patterns that matched sounds emanating from the grassy knoll, traveling carefully measured distances to nearby buildings and then bouncing off them to hit the open motorcycle transmitter. They also placed the unknown gunman behind a picket fence at the top of the grassy knoll, in front of and to the right of the presidential limousine. The House committee concluded that this shot missed, and that Kennedy was killed by a final bullet from Oswald's rifle. That, by the way, is nonsense. Oswald was a terrible shot. And FBI ballistics experts, expert riflemen, could not duplicate what Oswald was alleged to have done. Continuing, Thomas, by contrast, believes it was the shot from the knoll 0.7 seconds earlier that killed the president. The National Academy of Sciences panel, assigned to conduct further studies after the committee closed down, said in 1982 that the noises on the tape previously identified as gunshots, quote, were recorded about 1 minute after the president was shot, unquote. By the way, speaking of the National Academy of Sciences panel, that included the late Luis Alvarez, a scientist with the Lawrence Livermore Laboratory. He endorsed the untenable single bullet theory. He also attempted to discredit Peter Vogel's research into the Port Chicago explosion, saying that it could not have been a nuke. For the record, program number 163, among other programs, goes into that particular consideration. In For the Record program number 104, we also took a look at some of the forensic evidence concerning the House Select Committee's findings on the shot. I would note that Anthony Pelicano, Mark Furman's private investigator, ruled that in point of fact, in his opinion, the finding from the dicta belt and the Dallas Police Department recording, or on the Dallas Police Department recording apparatus, did not indicate there was a shot from the grassy knoll. Anthony Pelicano also noted in connection with the Watergate tapes that, in his opinion, the 18 seconds, but in any case, the gap on that famous Watergate tape could have, in fact, been an accident. Actually, it was an 18-minute gap. I would point out that Anthony Pelicano's findings in both have been disputed. There are profound connections between the Kennedy assassination and Watergate. In For the Record program number 253, I went into some of those connections, including some remarkable a remarkable account provided by Gordon Novell, one of the principal figures in Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans. And For the Record, 253 is not only available from Spitfire, but on a website that I will tell you more about. Returning once again to this Washington Post story from March 27th. It was dateline March 26th. No, it's a March 26th story. In any event, returning to this Washington Post story, speaking of the National Academy of Sciences panel that disputed that there had been a shot from the grassy knoll, the NAS experts, headed by physicist Norman F. Ramsey of Harvard, reached that conclusion after studying the sounds on the two radio channels Dallas police were using that day. Routine transmissions were made on Channel 1 and recorded on a dicta belt at police headquarters. An auxiliary frequency, Channel 2, was dedicated to the president's motorcade and used primarily by Dallas Police Chief Jesse Curry. Its transmissions were recorded on a separate gray audiograph disc machine. The shooting took place within an 18-second interval that began with Curry in the lead car announcing on Channel 2 that the motorcade was approaching a triple underpass and ended with the chief stating urgently, quote, go to the hospital, unquote. What seemed to be the gunshots were picked up on Channel 1 during that interval. The NAS panel pointed out that Dallas County Sheriff Bill Decker could be heard on both channels saying, quote, hold everything secure, unquote, seemingly about a half second after the last gunshot on Channel 1. Curry had already told everyone on Channel 2 a minute earlier to go to the hospital. As a result, the Ramsey panel concluded that the supposed shot noises came too late to be attributed to assassination shots, unquote. What actually happened was that Curry issued his go to the hospital, unquote, order right after the first shots were fired, wounding Kennedy and Texas Governor John Connally. The final bullet was fired in almost the same instant that Curry uttered his command. A minute later, Decker, riding in the same car with Curry, grabbed the mic and issued his orders to, quote, hold everything secure, unquote. The study's author said the chances that the National Academy of Sciences' single gunman theory was correct were 1 in 100,000. The NAS experts made several errors, Thomas said, but their biggest mistake was in using Decker's words to line up the two channels. They ignored a much clearer instance of crosstalk when Dallas Police Sergeant S.Q. Bella, B-E-L-L-A-H, can be heard on both channels asking, quote, you want me to hold this traffic on Stemmons until we find out something or let it go, unquote. Those remarks came 179 seconds after the last gunshot on Channel 1 and 180 seconds after Curry's order to go to the hospital, unquote, on Channel 2. When Bella's words are used to line up the two channels, Thomas found the gunshot sounds occur at the exact instant that John F. Kennedy was assassinated, unquote. How is it then that Decker's remarks on Channel 1 come a full minute after Curry's on Channel 2, and yet a half second after the last gunshot on Channel 1? It's a misplaced bit of speech, Thomas said in an interview, an overdub. The recording needle for Channel 1 probably jumped. You can hear Decker giving a whole set of instructions on Channel 2, but on Channel 1, you get only a fragment. Hold everything secure, unquote. According to Thomas, the NAS panel made other mistakes. In calculating the position of the grassy knoll shooter, in fixing the time of that shot, and in stating the Channel 2 recorder had stopped when it hadn't. Now, whether these were mistakes or deliberate obfuscation, I will leave up to the imagination of the listening audience. Continuing. In all, Thomas said, the chances of the NAS panel having been right were 1 in 100,000. In all, Thomas said, the chances, House Committee experts James Barger, Mark Weiss, and Eric Ashkenazi have always held firm to their findings of a shot from the grassy knoll. Similarly, Ramsey, as chairman of the NAS panel, said last weekend that he was still fairly confident, unquote, of his group's work, but said he wanted to study the Science and Justice article before making further comment. He said he did not recall the Bella crosstalk. Again, from the Washington Post of March 26th of the year 2001, the conclusion of a British scientific panel, there was in fact a fatal shot from the grassy knoll. And that again from the Washington Post, 3/26/2001. What we're going to do next is to review some information that we looked at in For the Record Program 190, dealing with other aspects of the House Select Committee on Assassinations findings and investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. And specifically, even though New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison has been widely and continually pilloried, the fact of the matter is there was a great deal of substance to his investigation. Basically, to make a long story short, Garrison was right, although, as any human being would, he made some mistakes. One of the most important books ever written about the Kennedy assassination, and a remarkably substantive and yet very short and readable book, was published in 1999 by Bill Davey, last name D-A-V-Y. That book was called Let Justice Be Done. The ISBN number is 0-9669716-0-4. The book was published in softcover by Jordan Publishing at 11654 Plaza America Drive, number 369, Reston, Virginia, 2190-4700. I interviewed Bill Davey in For the Record program number 190, and Bill Davey provides a great deal of documentation about the Garrison investigation, and one of the most remarkable pieces of research, one of the most remarkable elements of his research, concerns some of the findings that he relays from declassified government documents about what the House Select Committee on Assassinations found about the Kennedy assassination. Well, and specifically about aspects of Jim Garrison's investigation. One of the things that we did not get told about was that the House Select Committee on Assassinations assistant counsel, who was in charge with investigating the New Orleans and Cuban angles of the investigation, found that Clay Shaw, which was who Jim Garrison pursued once David Ferry passed away under strained circumstances, Clay Shaw was in all likelihood either a high-level planner of or a cutout to the planners of Kennedy's assassination. Recall that the jury in the Garrison investigation found that there had been a conspiracy, but they could not prove beyond a shadow of a doubt or beyond reasonable doubt that Clay Shaw was guilty. Turning to Let Justice Be Done by Bill Davey, we read, House Select Committee on Assassinations Chief Counsel G. Robert Blakey once referred to the committee's work as the last investigation, unquote. As such, it is only proper that the House Select Committee on Assassination have the last word on Clay Shaw. On September 1, 1977, Staff Counsel Jonathan Blackmer authored a 15-page memorandum addressed to Blakey, as well as staff members Gary Cornwell, Ken Klein, and Cliff Fenton. Blackmer, B-L-A-C-K-M-E-R, was the lead counsel for Team 3, The House Select Committee on Assassinations team responsible for the New Orleans and Cuban angles of the investigation. After an investigative trip to New Orleans, Blackmer concluded in his memo, quote, "We have reason to believe Shaw was heavily involved in the anti-Castro efforts in New Orleans in the 1960s and was possibly one of the high-level planners or cutout," unquote, to the planners of the assassination. And that, again, from a memo written to G. Robert Blakey, although Blakey has been less than candid in discussing that particular aspect of the investigation. A former deputy chief counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Robert Tannenbaum, reported seeing a film of a Lake Pontchartrain, Louisiana training camp used for the Bay of Pigs invasion and for some of the anti-Castro Cuban activities. The film of this training camp, or the apparent film, because it has now disappeared, showed Lee Harvey Oswald, David Ferry, the person who, quote, committed suicide, unquote, before he could be indicted by Garrison, as well as former CIA official David Attlee Phillips and Guy Bannister, the head of the Guy Bannister Detective Agency, for which Ferry worked, and at which Lee Harvey Oswald was apparently operating as the sole member of the Pro-Castro Fair Play for Cuba Committee, rather unusual since Guy Bannister was a rabid anti-communist involved with the anti-Castro efforts, and in light of the fact that Bannister's office was the head of the Anti-Communist League of the Caribbean, part of what eventually became incorporated into the World Anti-Communist League, about which we've spoken in, among other broadcasts, Radio RFA number 14 and 15. Of this training camp and former Deputy Chief Counsel Robert Tannenbaum's viewing of this, we read in Let Justice Be Done, "It is possible that a film once existed of this training camp. The former Deputy Chief Counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations, Robert Tannenbaum, recalled that the committee viewed the film, and to Tannenbaum, it was a shock to the system. Quote, "The movie was shocking to me because it demonstrated the notion that the CIA was training in America a separate army," he said. Again quoting, "It was shocking to me because I'm a true believer in the system, and yet there are notorious characters in the system who are funded by the system who are absolutely un-American. And who knows what they would do eventually? What if we send people to Washington who they can't deal with? Out comes their secret army? So I find that to be as contrary to the Constitution as you can get," unquote. What is even more shocking is what the film reveals. According to Tannenbaum, depicted in the film among the Cuban exiles was Guy Bannister, David Attlee Phillips of the CIA, and Lee Harvey Oswald. Inexplicably, the film would later disappear from the committee's files. And again, David Ferry was heavily involved with that particular training camp, again, the Lake Pontchartrain training camp. Another of the House Select Committee on Assassinations findings was that at a Clinton, Louisiana voter registration drive during the Civil Rights Movement, David Ferry and Lee Harvey Oswald and Clay Shaw can be credibly reported to have been present spying on the registration, or apparently spying on the registration. I would note that Ferry, of course, worked for the aforementioned Guy Bannister. There are numerous evidentiary tributaries linking Guy Bannister and Clay Shaw. And I would note that the Guy Bannister Detective Agency and Guy Bannister himself are very active against the civil rights movement. Bannister published something called the Louisiana Intelligence Digest, which maintained that the civil rights movement was part of a communist conspiracy. Returning once again to Let Justice Be Done by Bill Davey about the House Select Committee on Assassinations findings about the Ferry-Shaw-Oswald Association in Clinton, Louisiana, we read, "The chairman of the Clinton chapter of the Congress of Racial Equality, Corey Collins, was monitoring the drive outside the registrar's office when at approximately 10 a.m. he noticed the arrival of the car. Thinking they might be FBI, Collins studied the car and its occupants closely. As the car came to a stop, he noticed a young, white male exit the rear of the car and enter the registration line while the driver and the other passenger remained in the car. Later, under oath, at the trial of Clay Shaw in 1969 and in his testimony to the House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1978, Collins would identify the driver of the car as Clay Shaw, the passenger as David Ferry, and the person in the registration line as Lee Harvey Oswald. And more about Clinton, Louisiana angle, and also about the conclusions of the House Select Committee and their vindication of Jim Garrison, Bill Davey writes as follows. A mere 4 years later, Congress would conclude that the House Select Committee on Assassinations was inclined to believe that Oswald was in Clinton, Louisiana in late August and early September of 1963, and that he was in the company of David Ferry, if not Clay Shaw. The Clinton witnesses established an association of undetermined nature between Ferry, Shaw, and Oswald less than 3 months before the assassination, unquote. The committee added that they, quote, also found that there was at least a possibility that Oswald and Guy Bannister were acquainted, unquote. They further concluded that the CIA Mafia Cuban plots had all the elements necessary for a successful assassination conspiracy, unquote. It is probably the ultimate irony that the U.S. government's conclusions echoed those of Jim Garrison's a decade earlier. And I would note that among the recommendations to the Department of Justice never followed up on was that they investigate David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans. There is abundant evidence that David Ferry was deeply involved in the anti-Castro Cuban efforts, and I would note that Eulalio del Valle, one of his associates in the anti-Castro effort on behalf of U.S. intelligence, was murdered, and that Garrison found out about that murder the day he found out about David Ferry's, quote, suicide, unquote. And as we're going to see, one of the people investigating the Del Valle Ferry Association turned out to himself have been deeply involved with the CIA's anti-Castro efforts, may very well have been involved in the assassination itself, and also had his name crop up later in connection with the assassination of Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C. We've taken a look at the assassination of Letelier, its connections to Operation Condor, U.S. intelligence, and George Bush's CIA, and the connections of that milieu to the Iran-Contra scandal and also the Florida vote machinations in For the Record 268 and other programs available from Spitfire. Bill Davey writes of Bernardo de Torres, this infiltrator into Garrison's investigation, and of the Ferry Del Valle relationship as follows. And note again what the House Select Committee found. This will come later in this passage. In the early days of the investigation, Garrison was interested in obtaining information on David Ferry's putative paymaster, Eulalio del Valle. The reader will recall that Ferry reportedly flew firebombing missions over the Cuban sugarcane fields at the behest of del Valle. Del Valle was a former Cuban congressman turned anti-Castro activist who operated out of Miami, Florida. On the day Ferry died, del Valle was found brutally murdered in his car in the parking lot of a Miami shopping center. Prior to that, Garrison had sent a part-time investigator named Bernardo de Torres to question Del Valle. De Torres was a military coordinator for the Brigade 2506 part of the Exile Landing Force during the Bay of Pigs invasion. He was captured by Castro's forces and detained until Christmas Eve of 1962. He eventually found his way to New Orleans, where, according to de Torres, he was approached by Sergeant Duffy of the New Orleans Police Department and asked to join Garrison's staff. As with many other investigators and volunteers at Tulane and Broad, de Torres's bona fides are suspect. First of all, it was de Torres who showed up at the DA's office in New Orleans very early in Garrison's investigation, claiming he had important information. He said he was a private detective who wanted to help and dropped the name of Miami DA Richard Gerstein as an entree. Shortly after de Torres was given the assignment to question del Valle, del Valle's brutalized body was discovered in the vicinity of de Torres's Miami apartment. By the way, he had his head split open, was shot in the heart at point-blank range, del Valle, that is, and had been tortured. Continuing with Davy's account, it was later determined that de Torres was filing reports on Garrison to the Miami CIA station JM Wave. Not long after he left Garrison's staff, de Torres went to work for Mitch Werbel's Military Armament Corporation, a large supplier of weaponry to the CIA. The House Select Committee on Assassinations developed evidence that de Torres was actually a CIA officer with links to military intelligence. A well-connected anti-Castro Cuban, Arturo Cobos told the FBI that De Torres was, quote, the man to call with contacts on a high level with the CIA in Washington, D.C., unquote. And note the House Select Committee's findings on De Torres. The House Select Committee on Assassinations also came into possession of investigative information which indicated that De Torres may have been in Dealey Plaza at the time of the assassination, and further, that he may have been involved in an assassination conspiracy, charges which De Torres denied. As for Garrison, he later came to believe that De Torres was one of his earliest sources of misinformation and recalled that whatever information De Torres provided never went anywhere. In the late 1970s, De Torres would be linked to the bombing assassination of Chilean leader Orlando Letelier in Washington, D.C. We most recently discussed, by the way, the Letelier assassination in For the Record program number 284. And I would note that George Bush was director of the CIA, and there are strong links between the Iran-Contra scandal and the assassination of Orlando Letelier and the Bay of Pigs and the assassination of President Kennedy. And one of the many evidentiary tributaries running between the Iran-Contra scandal, in which George Bush was primarily involved, and the assassination of President Kennedy, was none other than Barry Seal, the Iran-Contra drug smuggler par excellence, murdered in 1986, and as we looked at in For the Record program number 181, one of Barry Seal's planes, 08 Foxtrot, was the plane that George Bush had as his vehicle of choice when he was governor of Texas. That's George II, George W. Bush. We're going to take a look now at an excerpt about an upcoming book about Barry Seal. This is from the issue of High Times magazine. Specifically, this is from High Times issue number 30. And this is an issue all about conspiracies of one kind or another. And this particular High Times article is by Preston Peet, last name P-E-E-T. It's titled Inside the Octopus, subtitled The Barry Seal Story, and this in turn accesses information about an upcoming book by Dan Hopsicker called Barry and the Boys. Adler Berryman Barry Seal was born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana on July 16, 1939, to a typical American family. Barry, his two brothers Benji and Wendell, his mom a homemaker, and his dad a candy wholesaler, lived in a house on Lover's Lane. During his teens, Barry would bicycle to Ryan's Field to watch airplanes in action. Seal's first flight instructor, Eddie Dufard, told Dan Hopsicker, author of the new book Barry and the Boys, that Barry was a skinny kid with a paper route, but he was always trying to prove something. That boy was first cousin to a bird, recalled Dufard. On July 16, 1955, his 16th birthday, Seal got his pilot's license. 2 weeks later, he boarded a U.S. Air Force plane for a two-week summer camp with the Civil Air Patrol at Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport, Louisiana. There, he came under the command of David Ferry and met fellow cadet Lee Harvey Oswald, two principal figures in the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. So Seal and the same Civil Air Patrol unit that David Ferry commanded and in which Lee Harvey Oswald was a member, and he got to know both. Still later, on May 1, 1963, Seal was assigned to Company D, Special Ops Detachment of the 20th Special Forces Group, Special Forces Group Airborne. By the way, that group was giving military training to the Ku Klux Klan, as we saw, and it also was apparently involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King. Continuing, during this time, just before President Kennedy was killed, an illuminating photograph was taken. A smiling 24-year-old Seal is seated at a nightclub table in Mexico City with Frank Sturgis, Felix Rodriguez, and William Seymour, all members of the CIA's assassination squad, Operation 40. Luis Godin, an air traffic controller at Redbird Airport, located south of Dallas, told the FBI he recalled observing three men in business suits board a Comanche-type aircraft hours after the assassination. Seal owned such a plane, and many believe he flew the plane that spirited the assassins to Canada. Of course, Felix Rodriguez deeply involved in Iran-Contra. There is an annotated and detailed description of For the Record program number 288 on the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. Real audio files of the For the Record programs are on sister station WFMU's website at wfmu.org/Dave Emery. That concludes For the Record program number 288, update on the Kennedy assassination. This is being recorded on April 8th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.